The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tap, also on them.
Service plan required for watch or tap. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to part three of the Presidents of America. We're going to run from number 21 to number 30. We'll start with number 21. A lot of these guys I've never actually heard of. This is another one, Chester A. Arthur. I don't know if anyone outside of America has ever heard of him. He was the son of a Baptist preacher who emigrated from Northern Ireland. He was America's 21st president, and he reigned, is that the right word? I don't think it is the right word. It's not a reign, is it? He governed from 1851 to 1881, my apologies, to 1885, succeeding President James Garfield upon his assassination. He was a dignified, tall, handsome, and clean-shaven man, apart from a wonderful moustache that he had. He looked like a president. Now, I always think this is one of the things in America. And this is why I wasn't a huge fan of Joe Biden. This was before he became president. I certainly wasn't a fan during his tenure. But he didn't look presidential. Like, I think a president needs to look the part. My timeline of presidents is obviously only from 1990. But Bill Clinton, he looked like a president. He was strong. He was tall. I know Biden was tall, but he frail old man. George Bush, again, looked like a president. Donald Trump looks like a president. I know he's got a bit of a belly on him, but he still looks like a president. Barack Obama, the epitome of strength. You look at a picture of a Barack Obama, especially in his earlier campaign, he looked extremely presidential, extremely strong and tall and powerful. And I think that's what a president should be. But obviously Chester A. Arthur, he had that look about him. He graduated from Union College in 1848. He was admitted to the bar and practiced law in New York City. Early in the Civil War, he served as a quartermaster general of the state of New York. And President Grant, in 1871, appointed him collector of the port of New York. Arthur effectively marshalled the 1,000 Customs House employees under his supervision. He was given powerful roles in the city of New York. And for any of you who are living under a rock, you will know that the city of New York is one of the biggest cities in the world, and especially in the 1800s, it was the port of entry for all immigration, or majority of immigration into America. So getting a role in New York like this was huge. He was honorable in his personal and his public career. Arthur, nevertheless, was a firm believer in the spoils system. When it was coming under attack from reformers. He believed in it. He has insisted upon honest administration of the Customs House, but staffed it with more employees than it needed. This was retaining them for jobs when he progressed throughout the government system. In 1878, President Hayes, attempting to reform the Customs House, ousted Arthur, and his followers tried to win regardless by fighting the renomination of Grant in 1880 at the Republican Convention. They obviously failed, but they accepted the nomination of Arthur for vice presidency. During his brief tenure as vice president, Arthur stood firmly beside Conklin in his postage struggle against President Garfield. When Arthur seceded to the presidency, he was eager to prove himself above machine politics. In 1883, Congress passed the Pendleton Act, which established a bipartisan civil service commission. Forbade levying political assessments against the office holders and provided a classified system that made certain government positions only obtainable through competitive written examination. In other words, you had to be qualified for the job. You could no longer appoint your friends. Acting independently, Arthur also tried to lower tariff rates so the government would not be embarrassed by annual surpluses of revenue. Congress raised about as many rates as it trimmed, but Arthur signed the Traffic Act of 1883, which aggrieved the Westerners and the Southerners, and looked to the Democratic Party for a response. Arthur's administration enacted the first general federal immigration law, and Arthur approved a measure in 1882 excluding paupers, criminals, and lunatics. Congress suspended Chinese immigration for 10 years and then brought that back. Now, what I find interesting about that is it says quite clearly, paupers, criminals, and lunatics. Now, if I'm right in my assessment, even today, people who have a criminal record in their own country are not allowed to visit America. And the only reason I know this is because one of my family members has got a checkered past, and he is not allowed to enter America, not even for a holiday. Now, I find that fascinating because we don't have such a policy in this country, and I really, really wish we did. And this is one of the main issues in the world right now, is the immigration from other countries into Western countries, and having a law like that that basically says you are not a good person, or you have done bad things in your past, therefore we don't really want you in here. I think that's a great policy. I think it's something we should adopt in this country, but we'll leave that for another day. Arthur demonstrated as president that he was above factions within the Republican Party, if indeed not above the party itself. Perhaps in part his reason was well kept secret. He had known since a year after he seceded to the presidency, and that was that he was suffering from a fatal kidney disease. He actually kept himself in the running for the presidential nomination in 1884 in order not to appear that he had feared defeat. Obviously, he knew that his life was coming to an end. He actually died in 1886, which gives him, obviously, this is why he knew that he was going to lose the election, or even if he didn't lose it, he wanted to make sure that people believed he was not giving up the fight. You know, he wanted to still put his hat in the race. He didn't want to go out like a wimp. He wanted to keep himself in that position, and I think that's a very, very credible thing for someone to achieve. Now, we're going to move on to President number 22. For those of you who are a little bit ahead of me, this is President number 22 and number 24. This is President Grover Cleveland. Now, he was the first Democratic elected after the Civil War in 1885, and he was the 22nd and 24th president. Grover Cleveland was the only president to leave the White House and return for a second term for 4 years later. That was until Donald Trump. He was the first Democratic elected, he was the first Democrat, not the first democratically elected, the first Democrat, so not Republican, Democrat. He was one of nine children of a Presbyterian minister. Cleveland was born in New Jersey, 1837, and he was raised in upstate New York as a lawyer in Buffalo. He became notable for his single-minded concentration upon whatever task he faced. Wow, I don't know why you guys come back and listen, to be honest. I can't even speak in legible sentences. But basically, he was quite an impressive guy. If he wanted to do something, he put his mind to it, he stuck to it, and that's what he did. At 44, he emerged into political prominence that carried him to the White House in 3 years. Running as a reformer, he was elected mayor of Buffalo in 1881 and later governor of New York. Cleveland won the presidency with the combined support of Democrats and reform Republicans, who disliked the record of his opponent, James G. Blaine of Maine. Blaine of Maine. He was a bachelor. Cleveland was ill at ease at first with all the comforts of the White House. He said, "I must go to dinner," which is what he wrote. "I wish it was to eat a pickled herring and Swiss cheese and a chop at Lewis." I don't know what that means, a chop at Lewis. "Instead of the French stuff that I shall find here." Anyone explain to me what a chop at Lewis is, or chop at Louis? I have no idea. But basically, he was a real man. He didn't want all the fancy crap that he got at the White House. He didn't want the fancy meals. He wanted to just go and eat fish and cheese. He was just a normal guy. So that's another thing. And this is what I think our politics absolutely lacks now is people like this. Real people who have come from, you know, real families. Not these silver spoon people who have been brought up through politics their entire life. Their mum was a politician, their dad was a politician, or in the case of the current president, they were born a billionaire, you know, or born a multi-millionaire and then created, you know. I think real people should run the country, not these. Anyway, we'll leave that. In June 1886, Cleveland married 21-year-old Frances Folsom. He was the only president in US history to actually be married whilst he was president. And that is, not be married, become married, become a married man during his tenure. Cleveland vigorously pursued a policy barring special favors to any economic group, vetoing a bill to appropriate $10,000 to distribute seed grain amongst drought-stricken farmers in Texas. He wrote, "Federal aid in such cases encourage the expectation of paternal care on the part of the government and weakens the sturdiness of our national character." That's going to be controversial because it's one of these, I would say, very right-wing policies in nowadays, which is like a laissez-faire, like Neville Chamberlain, leave it alone, let people get on with their lives. We don't need to help them, because if we help them, they're going to expect help all the time. In certain circumstances, I totally agree with that policy. I think when you're talking about, in this particular incident, farmers who feed and keep the country going, I think that may have been quite a controversial thing, and maybe something that didn't go as a feather in his cap. He also vetoed private pension bills to Civil War veterans whose claims were fraudulent. When Congress pressured the Grand Army of the Republic, it passed a bill granting pensions for disabilities not caused by military services. And this was vetoed. The Congress vetoed it, and so did Cleveland. Again, personally, I think anybody who's fought and lost friends, families, or parts of themselves in war for their country, I don't care. If I have a soldier who's retired from the army and then he starts working and then he breaks his arm or does something to him that he'll never be able to work again, I think the war pension should be picked up on that. My personal opinion, I may be controversial, but if someone who sacrificed everything for the freedom of this country, or in America in that case, I think we should look after them for the rest of their lives, regardless of what happens. That may be I may be controversial there, but I can't imagine many people disagree with me on that. He angered the railroads by ordering an investigation of Western lands that they held by government grant. He forced them to return 81 million acres, and he also signed the Interstate Commerce Act, which was the first law attempting federal regulations of the railroads. In 1887, he called on Congress to reduce high protective tariffs and told that he'd given Republicans an effective issue for the campaign of 1888. He basically said, "What is the use of being elected or re-elected unless you stand for something?" Cleveland was defeated in 1888, although he won a larger popular majority than the Republican candidate Benjamin Harrison, and he received fewer Electoral College votes. So we saw this in 2016 when Donald Trump won. Hillary Clinton got the majority of the votes. Donald Trump got the majority of the electoral votes. That's the only one I can remember in my lifetime. I'm sure there are others, but I find that system very, very strange, because surely the most popular candidate should be the winner. But I can't say anything, because in our country, the government only got 30% of the votes, and they are the government. So, you know, I think your thing is a bit weird. Ours is 100% weird. How can you have a coalition or a party in charge of the entire political system when only a third of the country actually want them there? Doesn't really make sense. This is one of the reasons why I do like your two-party system in America. However, we do have a lot broader politics in this country, with sort of five or six main political parties. He was elected again in 1892. Cleveland faced faced depression, basically. He dealt directly with the treasury crisis rather than with the business failures, farm, mortgage, foreclosures, and unemployment. He obtained repeal of the mildly inflationary Sherman Silver Purchase Act, with the aid of Wall Street, and maintained the Treasury's gold reserve. So he dealt with it like an economic depression, and he dealt with it as best he could. When the railroad strikers in Chicago violated an injunction, Cleveland sent federal troops to enforce it. "If it takes the entire Army and Navy of the United States to deliver a postcard in Chicago, that card will be delivered." That's pretty strong words. Like I said, pretty strong guy. Cleveland's blunt treatment of the railroad strikers stirred the pride of many Americans. So did the vigorous way in which he forced Great Britain to accept arbitration of a disputed boundary in Venezuela. But his policies during the Depression were generally unpopular. His party deserted him and nominated William Jennings Bryan in 1896. After leaving the White House, Cleveland retired in Princeton, and he died in 1908. Now, I'm going to have to look into this because I've never heard of the arbitration of disputed boundary in Venezuela. So that's going to be interesting, I think, because I haven't got a clue about that. So I'm going to definitely look into that and see where he beat us. I know America love lording over the victory of 1776. So, I want to find out where he's actually beaten us again, because I've never even heard of that. So we mentioned him in the last one, Benjamin Harrison. He was the 23rd president of the United States from 1889 to 1893. So he was in the middle of the Cleveland sandwich. He was nominated for president on the 8th ballot in the 1888 Republican Convention. Benjamin Harrison conducted one of the first front porch campaigns, delivering short speeches to delegations that visited him in Indianapolis. He was only 5'6" tall, and Democrats called him Little Ben. Ooh, you know, reading things like this really winds me up. 5'6" is not little. I am 5'6". It's not little. Anyone who looks at a picture of me, you will not say he's little. Yeah, 5'6" is not small. I definitely have a Napoleon complex, by the way, if anyone's wondering. Born in 1833 on a farm by the Ohio River below Cincinnati, Harrison attended Miami University in Ohio and read law in Cincinnati. He moved to Indianapolis, where he practiced law and campaigned for the Republican Party. He married Carolina Lavina Scott in 1853 after the Civil War. He was colonel of the 70th Volunteer Infantry. Harrison became a pillar of Indianapolis and enhanced his reputation by becoming a brilliant lawyer. The Democrats defeated him for governor in Indiana in 1876 by unfairly stigmatizing him as Kids Gloves Harrison. So again, using his height as something to get against him. I kind of understand it, because I remember Donald Trump run a campaign on Sleepy Joe. I know obviously Joe Biden dropped out, but I mean, I distinctly remember early last year, one of the things he said was Sleepy Joe. So I can understand how just that one little nickname can change an entire people's opinion of someone. In the presidential election, Harrison received 100,000 fewer votes than Cleveland, but carried the Electoral College 233 to 168. Now that's a massive, massive advantage. Although Harrison had made no political bargains, his supporters had given innumerable pledges upon his behalf. When boss Matt Key of Pennsylvania heard that Harrison ascribed his narrow victory to Providence, Key exclaimed that Harrison would never know how close a number of men were compelled to approach. Basically, people didn't want him as president. He had to be made president. Does that make sense? Because you can be popular in your state, that's not necessarily going to transgress to the entire United States. So people pushed him into that position. You know, whether he was a good president, we shall find out. Because just because you're pushed into a job doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be bad at it. Harrison was proud of the vigorous foreign policy which he helped shaped. The first Pan-American Congress met in Washington in 1889, establishing an information center, which later became the Pan-American Union. At the end of his administration, Harrison submitted to the Senate a treaty to annex Hawaii. To his disappointment, President Cleveland later withdrew it. Substantial appropriation bills were signed by Harrison for internal improvements, naval expansion, and subsidies for steamship lines. For the first time except in war, Congress appropriated $1 billion. When critics attacked the $1 billion Congress, Speaker Thomas B. Reed replied, "This is a billion-dollar country." Now it's a trillion-dollar country. President Harrison also signed the Sherman Antitrust Act to protect trade and commerce against unlawful restraints and monopolies, the first federal act attempting to regulate trusts. The most perplexing domestic problem Harrison faced was the tariff issue. The high tariff rates in effect had created a surplus of money in the Treasury. Low tariff advocates argued that the surplus was hurting business. Republican leaders in Congress successfully met the challenge. Representative William McKinley and Senator Nelson Aldrich framed a still higher tariff bill, and some rates were intentionally prohibitive. Harrison tried to make the tariff more acceptable by writing in reciprocity provisions to cope with the Treasury surplus. The tariff was removed from imported sugar. Sugar growers within the United States were given 2 cents a pound on their production. Long after the end of Harrison's administration, the Treasury surplus had evaporated. A prosperity seemed to disappear. Congressional elections in 1890 went stirringly against the Republicans, and leaders decided to abandon President Harris, although he had cooperated with Congress on party legislation. Nevertheless, his party did renominate him in 1892, but he was defeated by Grover Cleveland. After he left office, Harrison returned to Indianapolis and married the widowed Miss Mary Dimmick in 1896. He was a dignified elder statesman, and he died in 1901. I'm not going to cover President 24 because we've already done that. That's Grover Cleveland. So we'll go straight to number 25. This is President William McKinley. This is one I've heard of. I have heard of Grover Cleveland as well, by the way, purely on the basis that Donald Trump's just done the same thing that he did. So it sort of it is spoken about. William McKinley was the 25th president of the United States, serving from March the 4th, 1897, until his assassination on September the 14th, 1901. You've got a real problem with assassinations, by the way. After leading the nation to victory in the Spanish-American War and raising protective tariffs to promote American industry, at the 1896 Republican Convention, in the time of depression, the wealthy Cleveland businessman Marcus Alonzo Hanna ensured the nomination of his friend William McKinley as the advance agent of prosperity. The Democrats, advocating the free and unlimited coinage of both silver and gold, which would have mildly inflated the currency, nominated William Jennings Bryan. While Hanna used large contributions from Eastern Republicans, frightened by Bryan's views on silver, McKinley met delegations on his front porch in Canton, Ohio. He won by the largest majority of popular votes since 1872. Born in Niles, Ohio in 1843, McKinley briefly attended Allegheny College, and he was teaching in country school when the Civil War broke out. Enlisting as a private in the Union Army, he was mustered out at the end as a brevet major. I'm not sure what a brevet major is. I think that might be an old military term of volunteers. He studied law, opened an office in Canton, Ohio, and married Ida Saxton, the daughter of a local banker. At 34, McKinley won a seat in Congress. His attractive personality, exemplary character, and quick intelligence enabled him to rise rapidly. He was appointed to the powerful Ways and Means of the Committee. Robert M. La Follette, senior, that is, who served with him, recalled that he generally represented the newer view, and on great new questions was generally on the side of the public and against private interests. During his 14 years in the House, he became the leading Republican tariff expert, giving his name to the measure enacted in 1890. The next year, he was elected governor of Ohio, serving two terms. When McKinley became president, the Depression of 1893 had almost run its course, and with it, the extreme agitation over silver. Deferring action on the money question, he called Congress into a special session to enact the highest tariff in history. In the friendly atmosphere of the McKinley administration, industrial combinations developed an unprecedented pace. Newspapers captured McKinley as a little boy led around by Nursey Hannah, the representative of the trusts. However, McKinley was not dominated by Hannah. He condemned the trusts as dangerous conspiracies against the public good. Not prosperity, but foreign policy dominated McKinley's administration, reporting the stalemate between Spanish forces and revolutionaries in Cuba. Newspapers screamed that the quarter of the population was dead and rest were suffering acutely. Public indignation brought pressure upon the president for war. Unable to restrain Congress or the American people, McKinley delivered his message of neutral intervention in April 1898. Congress thereupon voted three resolutions tantamount to the declaration of war and the liberation and independence of Cuba. The 100-day war, the United States destroyed the Spanish fleet outside of Santiago Harbor in Cuba, seized Manila in the Philippines, and occupied Puerto Rico. Uncle Joe Cannon, Speaker of the House, once said that McKinley kept his ear so close to the ground that it was full of grasshoppers. When McKinley was undecided what to do about the Spanish possessions other than Cuba, he toured the country and detected imperialist sentiment. Thus, the United States annexed the Philippines, Guam, and Puerto Rico. In 1900, McKinley again campaigned against Bryan. While Bryan, he was against imperialism, McKinley stood for the full dinner pail. His second term, which began auspiciously, came to a tragic end in September 1901. He was standing in a receiving line at the Buffalo Pan American Exposition when a deranged anarchist shot him twice, and he died 8 days later. For those of you who are interested, we have got on Patreon the assassinations of the presidents. There is a special, I think it's a four-part episode. And I also did one on Roosevelt, who was shot but wasn't killed. So there's a few assassinations or assassination attempts on Patreon. So if you're interested in that side of it and just the specific details of the assassinations, get over to Patreon. Speaking of Theodore Roosevelt, probably one of the most famous presidents in US history, the 26th president of the United States. With the assassination of President William McKinley, Theodore Roosevelt, not quite 43, became the 26th and youngest president in the nation's history. He was president from 1901 to 1909, and he brought a new excitement and power to the office, vigorously leading Congress and the American public towards progressive reforms and a strong foreign policy. He took the view that the president, as the steward of the people, should take whatever action necessary for the public good unless expressly forbidden by the law or the Constitution. I did not usurp power, he wrote, but I did greatly broaden the use of executive power. Roosevelt's youth differed sharply from that of the log cabin presidents. He was born in New York City in 1858 into a wealthy family, but he too struggled against ill health and in his triumph became an advocate of the strenuous life. In 1884, his first wife, Alice Lee Roosevelt, and his mother died on the same day. That is bad luck. Roosevelt spent much of the next 2 years on his ranch in the broadlands of the Dakota Territory. There, he mastered his sorrow as he lived in a saddle. driving cattle, hunting big game.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel, because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Game, he even captured an outlaw. On a visit to London, he married Edith Caro in December 1886. During the Spanish-American War, Roosevelt was a lieutenant colonel of the Rough Rider Regiment, which he led on a charge at the Battle of San Juan. He was one of the most conspicuous heroes of the war. Boss Tom Platt, needing a hero to draw attention away from the scandals in New York, accepted Roosevelt as the Republican candidate for governor in 1898. Roosevelt won and served with distinction. As President Roosevelt held the idea that the government should be an arbiter of the nation, especially between the capital and labor, guaranteeing justice to each and dispensing favors to none. Roosevelt emerged spectacularly as a trust buster by forcing the dissolution of the great railroad combination of the Northwest. Other antitrust suits under the Sherman Act followed. Roosevelt steered the United States more actively into world politics. He liked to quote the proverb, "Speak softly and carry a big stick." Aware of the strategic need for a shortcut between the Atlantic and Pacific, Roosevelt ensured the construction of the Panama Canal. His colliery to the Monroe Doctrine prevented the establishment of foreign bases in the Caribbean and arrogated the sole right of intervention on Latin America to the United States. He won the Nobel Peace Prize for mediating the Japan-Russia War and reached a gentleman's agreement on immigration with Japan and sent the Great White Fleet on a goodwill tour of the world. Some of Theodore Roosevelt's most effective achievements were in conservation. He added enormously to the national forests in the West, reserved lands for public use, and fostered great irrigation projects. He crusaded endlessly on matters big and small, exciting audiences with his high-pitched voice, jutting jaw, and pounding fist. The life of strenuous endeavor was the must for those around. He romped with his five younger children. I'm not sure I like that word. He played with his five younger children and led ambassadors on hikes through Rocky Creek Park in Washington, D.C. Leaving the presidency in 1909, Roosevelt went on an African safari, then jumped back into politics in 1912. He ran for president on a progressive ticket. To reporters, he once remarked that he felt as fit as a bull moose. So that was the name of his new party, the Bull Moose Party. While campaigning in Milwaukee, he was shot in the chest by a fanatic, and Roosevelt soon recovered, but his words at that time would have been applicable at the time of his death in 1919, and this was, "No man had a happier life than I have led, a happier life in every way." Theodore Roosevelt, he's got to go down as probably one of the most fantastic presidents of all time. I don't really think there's a bad word to say about the guy. Everything he did seemed to be pretty good. You know, he's just one of those guys. He just made the job better. And that's why he's gone down in history. I mean, he really has gone down in history as one of the greatest presidents of all time. And you're talking over 100 years ago, you know, really. And I say this in the nicest way possible. America is an extremely young country. The 26th president, you're talking about 20 presidents before him, 20 presidents after him. He shouldn't have been the best, really. He should have been a benchmark for people to improve upon. It's a young country, and he still looked at as one of the greatest presidents of all time. And I'm sure there are people on here who hate him and can tell me something about him that isn't on here, that, you know, he wasn't that great, or he did something wrong, or something like that. But his actual achievements as president, second to none, as far as I can tell. Moving on, the 27th president of the United States, William Howard Taft. William Howard Taft was elected the 27th president of the United States from 1909 to 1913, and he later became the 10th Chief Justice of the United States from 1921 to 1930. He is the only person to have served in both of these offices. Distinguished jurist, effective administrator, but poor politician. William Howard Taft spent 4 uncomfortable years in the White House. Large, jovial, conscientious, he was caught in the intense battles between progressives and conservatives and got scant credit for the achievements of his administration. Born in 1857, son of distinguished judge, he graduated from Yale and returned to Cincinnati to study and practice law. He rose in politics through Republican judiciary appointments, though his own competence and availability, he once wrote facetiously, he had his plate the right side up when the offices were falling. Not really sure what that actually means, but that's what he said. The plate is the right side up when the offices are falling. So anyway, read into that what you will. Taft much preferred law to politics. He was appointed federal circuit judge at 34, and he aspired to be a member of the Supreme Court. But his wife, Helen Heron, that's a weird name, held other ambitions for him. His route to the White House was via administrative posts, and President McKinley sent him to the Philippines in 1900 as a chief civil administrator. Sympathetic towards the Filipinos, he improved the economy, built roads and schools, and gave the people at least some participation in government. President Roosevelt made him Secretary of War, and by 1907, he decided that Taft should be his successor. The Republican convention nominated him the next year. Taft disliked the campaign, and he said it was one of the most uncomfortable 4 months of his life. But he pledged his loyalty to the Roosevelt program, popular in the West, while his brother Charles reassured Eastern Republicans. William Jennings Bryan, running on the Democratic ticket for a third time, and he'd lost the previous two, complained that he was having to oppose 2 candidates, a Western progressive Taft and an Eastern conservative Taft. Progressives were pleased with Taft's election, and Roosevelt has his cut enough hay, they said. Taft is the man to put in the barn. Conservatives were more delighted to be rid of Roosevelt, as they considered him the mad messiah. Taft recognised that his techniques would differ from those of his predecessor, and unlike Roosevelt, Taft did not believe in stretching of presidential powers. He once commented that Roosevelt ought more often to have admitted the legal way of reaching the same ends. In other words, Roosevelt stretched the laws to make it work for him. Maybe that's one reason why someone might say he wasn't that good. I think at the end of the day, if you get the result, it doesn't matter. Taft aligned many liberal Republicans who later formed the Progressive Party by defending the Payne-Aldrich Act, which unexpectedly continued high tariff rates. A trade agreement with Canada, which Taft pushed through Congress, would have pleased Eastern advocates of a low tariff, but the Canadians rejected it. He further antagonized progressives by holding up his Secretary of the Interior, accused of failing to carry out Roosevelt's conservation policies. In the angry progressive onslaught against him, little attention was paid to the fact that his administration initiated 80 antitrust suits and the Congress submitted to the state's amendments for a federal income tax and the direct election of senators. A postal savings system was established and the Interstate Commerce Commission was directed to set the railroad rates. In 1912, when the Republicans renominated Taft, Roosevelt bolted the party and led the progressives, thus guaranteeing the election to Woodrow Wilson. And we have just seen this in this country. We had the Conservative Party, and then we have the Reform Party, though many of you have probably heard of the Reform Party. Now, normally in this country, we have Conservatives and we have Labour. Now, as I've just said, Labour got 30% of the national vote, and the Conservatives got roughly 24-25%. Reform, however, got around 15%. What Reform have done by joining as a new political party, they've split the right-wing vote in half, almost in half. And because of that, it's handed the election to Labour. So although Labour have only won 33%, I think it was 33% of the national vote, if the Conservatives and Reform votes crunched together, then one of them would have won. But the problem is, when you split a party in two, it splits the vote, it hands the win to the other person. Taft, free of the presidency, served as professor of law at Yale until President Harding made him Chief Justice of the United States. And that was a position he held until just before his death in 1930. To Taft, the appointment was his greatest honor. And he wrote, "I don't remember that I was ever president." He really didn't want to be president. Now, the man who took advantage of that split in the party, we're going to be talking about the 28th president, which is Woodrow Wilson. Again, this is another one that I know, by the way. Woodrow Wilson was a leader of the progressive movement and was the 28th president of the United States from 1913 to 1921. After a policy of neutrality at the outbreak of World War I, Wilson led America into war to make the world safe for democracy. And speaking as a Brit, thank you very much, Mr. Wilson, because who knows what would have happened if America hadn't stepped in the First World War. Second, not so sure, but the First World War, America were pivotal. Pivotal, is that the right word? I think it's the right word. They were essential. Like Roosevelt before him, Woodrow Wilson regarded himself as the personal representative of the people. No one but the president, he said, seems to be expected to look out for the general interests of the country. He developed a program of progressive reform and asserted international leadership in building a new world order. In 1917, he proclaimed America's entrance into World War I a crusade to make the world safe for democracy. Wilson had seen the frightfulness of war. He was born in Virginia, 1856, the son of a Presbyterian minister who during the Civil War was a pastor in Augusta, Georgia, and during the Reconstruction, a professor in the charred city of Columbia, South Carolina. After graduation from Princeton and the University of Virginia Law School, Wilson earned his doctorate at Johns Hopkins University and entered upon an academic career. In 1885, he married Ellen Lewis Axon, and Wilson advanced rapidly as a conservative young professor of political science and became president of Princeton in 1902. His growing national reputation led some conservative Democrats to consider him presidential timber. First, they persuaded him to run for governor of New Jersey in 1910. In the campaign, he asserted his independence of the Conservatives and of the machine that had nominated him, endorsing a progressive platform, which he pursued as governor. He was nominated for president at the 1912 Democratic Convention and campaigned on a program called New Freedom, which stressed individualism and states' rights. In the three-way election, he received only 42% of the popular vote, but an overwhelming electoral vote. Wilson maneuvered through Congress three major pieces of legislation. The first was a lower tariff called the Underwood Act, and that attached the measurement was a graduated federal income tax. So thank Woodrow Wilson that you pay tax. The passage of the Federal Reserve Act provided the nation with a more elastic money supply, which it badly needed. In 1914, the antitrust legislation established a Federal Trade Commission to prohibit unfair business practices. Another burst of legislation followed in 1916. One new law prohibited child labour, another limited railroad workers to an 8-hour day, and by virtue of this legislation, the slogan, "He kept us out of war." Wilson narrowly won re-election, but after the election, Wilson concluded that America could not remain neutral in the World War. And on April 2nd, 1917, he asked Congress for a declaration of war on Germany. Massive American efforts slowly tipped the balance in favor of the Allies, and it did, by the way, for any of those Brits out there who go, "Well, you didn't actually help us." They did. In the First World War, had it not been for the Americans, genuinely, the Germans could have won it. It was that close. So yeah, the Americans, without a shadow of a doubt, First World War, were essential. Wilson went before Congress in January 1918 to basically give his American war aims, the 14 points, the last of which would establish a General Association of Nations, affording mutual guarantees of political independence and territorial integrity to great and small states alike. Kind of the League of Nations. It was the Treaty of Versailles what then became important. It's that he was important in the League of Nations, which then, after the Second World War, became NATO. He asked, "Dare we reject it and break the heart of the world?" when the League of Nations was proposed. The election of 1918 had shifted the balance in Congress to the Republicans, and by 7 votes, the Versailles Treaty failed in the Senate. Which I never knew that, actually. I never realised that it didn't go through in America, the Treaty of Versailles. Not something I'd ever even known. The president, against the warnings of his doctors, had made a national tour to mobilise public sentiment for the treaty. Exhausted, he suffered a stroke and nearly died. Tenderly nursed by his second wife, he lived until 1924. Now that I find fascinating, because I knew, obviously, in this country we know about the Treaty of Versailles. Had no idea that when America produced the Treaty of Versailles to their Congress, your Congress said, "No, we're not really that interested." Because in this country, the Treaty of Versailles is massive. We're taught it in school. We're taught all about it. And the annexation of things like the Ruhr, the Rhineland, parts of Poland, that all got taken away from Germany and given to other countries. I mean, we learn all about this. All of the colonies in Africa that Germany had footholds in, they were all taken away from them. Kind of one of the reasons why the Second World War actually started. If you look into the things that Hitler said, one of the main reasons was they were dealt such a bad hand at the Treaty of Versailles that they wanted their land back. And, you know, had to an extent, you kind of can't blame them for wanting land that they've had for hundreds of years to go back to them. I mean, one of the main parts that was taken away from them, like I said, was the Rhineland, which was the industrial heartland of Germany. And that was given to France. So it would be like, I can't even think of an industrial part of America, but it'd be like someone coming and taking like Illinois, because I know Detroit is a massive industrial plus, and just saying, well, you can have the rest of the country, but you can't have that. Yeah, I can kind of see why the Second World War, why Germany did what they did. Genocide aside, by the way, for anyone who's not read between the lines there, obviously that's unacceptable. Getting diverted here. So we're going to go to the 29th President of the United States, Warren G. Harding. An Ohio Republican was born... was the 29th President of the United States. I was going to say born between 1921 and 1923. He wasn't born then. That's when he was president. So only 2 years. Through his time in office, he was fraught with scandal, including a teapot dome. He embraced technology and was sensitive to the plights of minorities and women. Ooh, a president who likes women. This is dangerous. Before nomination, Warren G. Harding declared, "America's present need is not heroics, but healing. Not normalcy, not revolution, but restoration. Not agitation, but adjustment. Not surgery, but serenity. And not the dramatic, but the dispassionate. Not experiment, but equipoise. And not submergence in internationality, but sentiment, sustainment in triumph nationalism." That is a long little quote there. A Democratic leader, William Gibbs McAdoo? I don't know, it sounds like a nursery rhyme, McAdoo. But anyway, called Harding's speeches an army of pompous phrases. Yeah, I agree with that. Moving across the landscape in search of an idea. It was definitely pompous. Their very murkiness was effective, since Harding's pronouncements remained unclear on the League of Nations. In contrast to the impassionate crusade of the Democrat candidates, Governor James Cox of Ohio and Franklin D. Roosevelt. 31 distinguished Republicans had signed a manifesto assuring voters that a vote for Harding was a vote for the League, but Harding interpreted his election as a mandate to stay out of the League of Nations. Harding, born near Marion, Ohio in 1865, became the publisher of a newspaper. He married a divorcee, Mrs. Florence King DeWolf, and he was a trustee of the Trinity Baptist Church, a director of almost every important business, and a leader in fraternal organizations and charitable enterprises. He organized the Citizens' Cornet Band, available for both Republicans and Democratic rallies, and he said, "I play every instrument but the slide trombone and the E-flat cornet." So he was pretty good at many instruments. One thing that I'm quite good at as well, just saying, and for those of you who know my dad, again, a very, very good musician. He plays the cornet, trumpet, trombone, French horn. I don't know if he plays the slide trombone, but basically any brass instrument my dad can pick up and play. I am the same with woodwind, so saxophone, clarinet, flute, recorder, basically any woodwind instrument, bagpipes I can also play. So, yeah, if anyone wants to get me a present, get me a set of bagpipes. By all means, just send me a message and I'll give you my address. I love the bagpipes. But anyway, so yeah, I'm with him on this musical front. Harding's undividing republicanism and vibrant speaking voice, plus his willingness to let the machine bosses set policies, led him far in Ohio politics. He served in the Senate as a lieutenant governor and unsuccessfully ran for governor. He delivered the nominating address for President Taft at the 1912 Republican Convention, and in 1914 he was elected to the Senate. The Senate, which he found a very pleasant place. An Ohio admirer, Henry Doherty, began to promote Harding for the 1920 Republican nomination because he later explained that he looked like a president. Thus, a group of senators taking control of the 1920 Republican Convention, when the principal candidates deadlocked, turned to Harding. He won the presidential election by an unprecedented landslide of 60% of the popular vote. That's massive. That's a 20% swing. Republicans in Congress got the president's signatures on their bills. They eliminated wartime controls, slashed taxes, established a federal budget system, and restored the high protective tariff. They also imposed tight limitations upon immigration. By 1923, the post-war depression seemed to be giving away to a new surge of prosperity, and newspapers hailed Harding as a wise statesman carrying out his campaign. Less government in business and more business in government. Behind the facade, not all of Harding's administrations were so impressive. Word had begun to reach the president that some of his friends were using their official positions for their own enrichment. Alarmed, he complained, "My friends, they're the ones that keep me walking the floors at night." Looking worn and depressed, Harding journeyed westward in the summer of 1923, taking with him his upright Secretary of Commerce, Herbert Hoover. "If you knew of great scandal in your administration," he asked Hoover, "would you, for the good of the country and the party, expose it, or would you bury it?" Hoover urged that you publicize it, but Harding feared the political repercussions. He did not live to find out how the public would react to the scandals of his administration, as in August 1923, he died in San Francisco of a heart attack. In other words, all of that stress killed him. He just couldn't deal with it. The 30th president, and the last one for this episode, Calvin Coolidge. As America's 30th president from 1923 to 1929, Calvin Coolidge demonstrated his determination to preserve the old moral and economic precepts of frugality amid the material prosperity which many Americans were enjoying during the 1920s era. A lot of big words there. Basically, he wanted to keep the roaring 20s going. It's probably a nice and easier way of putting that. For those of you who don't know, the Roaring Twenties was a massive prosperity in America, which led to the Great Depression a few years later. At 2:30 on the morning of August the 3rd, 1923, while visiting in Vermont, Calvin Coolidge received word that he was the president. By the light of a kerosene lamp, his father, who was a notary public, administered the oath of office as Coolidge placed his hand on the family Bible. That's pretty impressive. So he didn't actually swear himself in. He did it at home on a Bible. Man, that's quite impressive. Coolidge was distinguished for character more than for heroic achievement, wrote a Democrat admirer, Alfred E. Smith. His great task was to restore the dignity and prestige of the presidency when it had reached the lowest ebb in our history, in a time of extravagance and waste. Born in Plymouth, Vermont on the 4th of July, born on Independence Day, 1872, Coolidge was the son of a villager storekeeper. He was graduated from the Amherst College with honours, and entered law and politics in Northampton, Massachusetts. Funny that, I'm in Northampton, England. Slowly, methodically, he went up the political ladder from councilman in Northampton to governor of Massachusetts. As a Republican, en route, he became thoroughly conservative. As a president, Coolidge demonstrated his determination to preserve the old moral and economic precepts amid the material prosperity with many Americans were enjoying at the time. He refused to use federal economic power to check the growing boom or the depressed condition of the agriculture and certain industries. His first message to Congress in December 1923 called for isolation in foreign policies and for tax cuts, economy, and limited aid to farmers. He became popular in 1924 as the beneficiary of what became known as Coolidge prosperity. He polled more than 54% of the popular vote, and in his inaugural he asserted that the country had achieved a state of contentment never before seen, and pledged himself to maintain the status quo. Well, why wouldn't you? If the country's in prosperity, you want to keep it the same. In subsequent years, he twice vetoed farm relief bills and killed a plan to produce cheap federal electric power on the Tennessee River. The political genius of President Coolidge, Walter Lippmann, pointed out in 1926, was that his talent for effectively doing nothing. This active inactivity suits the mood and certain of the needs of the country. It suits all the business and inserts which should be left alone. And it suits all of those who have become convinced that the government in this country has become dangerously complicated and top-heavy. Coolidge was both most negative and he was the most negative and remote of all presidents, and the most accessible. It's a very contrasting ability to have. He once explained to Bernard Brosh why he often sat silently through interviews. "Well, many times I only say yes or no to people. Even that is too much. It winds them up for 20 minutes. I like to do that, to be fair. We've all done that, haven't we? When we're having conversations that we don't really want to be in, you just go, yeah, no, yeah. And it does, it winds people up. It's brilliant. So, yeah, you've got a president doing that. No president was kinder in permitting himself to be photographed in Indian war bonnets or cowboy dress and in greeting a variety of delegations to the White House. Both his dry Yankee wit and his frugality with words became legendary. His wife, Grace Coolidge, recounted that a young woman sitting next to Coolidge at a dinner party confided to him that she had bet she could get at least three words out of a conversation with him. Without looking at her, he retorted, "You lose." And in 1928... while vacationing in Black Hills of South Dakota, he issued the most famous of his statements: "I do not choose to run for president in 1928. That's it. Man of very few words. By the time of the disaster of the Great Depression hit the country, Coolidge was in retirement, and before his death in January 1933, he confided with an old friend, and these were his last known words: "I feel I no longer fit with these times." So, yeah, a man of very few words and probably one of the most famous presidents of all time. Again, very famous, but he was famous for doing nothing. You know, he didn't really do anything. He just kept a good economy working, and that was it. That was enough for him to be successful. So, fair play to Calvin Coolidge. So for those of you who have, if you've just joined us and you've just listened to 21 to 30, you need to go back and listen to the previous two episodes. We have now covered from George Washington all the way up to Calvin Coolidge. We have 16 presidents left to go. So is it 16? Yeah, 16 presidents, because Trump was 46 and 47. So we have a few to go. It's 45 and 47, my apologies. So there's two more episodes. We're going to do 31 to 40 next, and then I'm going to cover the last seven presidents in a final episode. So for those of you who have got this on Patreon, congratulations, you've already listened to this. For those of you who haven't got this on Patreon, get yourselves over there. You'll be able to listen to the next two episodes earlier than everybody else. We charge $5 a month. It's less than a cup of coffee. Get yourselves over there. It benefits the podcast. It keeps us going. So, yeah, thanks for listening, guys. See you next time.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel, because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Access big savings every day. All in the Kroger app. Get tender Heritage Farm boneless chicken breast for $2.49 a pound. Then find low prices on thousands of items like sparkling ice water, Kroger brand chips, and more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.